If you have your Bibles, open up to Job. This is super. You may notice I'm wearing glasses, which I don't wear. These are old, and everything on my stand is blurry. Super. No, they're my only glasses. They're just older. So not completely blurry. It's, you know, so if you just see me like focusing intensely, that'll be fun. I had a couple eye infections earlier in the week, and so I can't wear my contacts. Yay. If you were here with us on Ash Wednesday, you should recognize the beginning of our passage this morning. Job's oxen and donkeys were taken, and a number of servants died. And then Job's sheep and even more servants were burned up in a fire. After that, violent attackers came and took Job's camels and killed more of Job's servants. And then, during a party where Job's sons and daughters were enjoying themselves, a strong wind came and caused the house to collapse, killing all of his children. I don't know if you recall from last week how the book of Job opened, but in verse 3, starting in verse 2, we were told there were born to Job 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. The end of chapter 1 then systematically tells the devastating story of Job losing all that he has. Oxen and donkeys, sheep, camels, servants, and then finally his own children. It's all gone. But that's only just the beginning. Job's personal and material loss is already incredible just by the end of this chapter, nearly complete. But then chapter 2 introduces us to unimaginable physical pain. Chapter 2, verse 7, tells us that the adversary went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Just a few verses later, 3 of Job's friends come along, and we're told that Job is not even recognizable because of what he's enduring. Job's pain and his suffering was so great that these friends were rendered speechless for 7 days and 7 nights. As I read this story, I feel 2 conflicting emotions. More than that, but these are 2 that I can sort of name and define. On the one hand, there's something that rises up in me when I read this story, a desire, a longing to be the kind of person, to have the kind of character, to have the fear of God, that in a moment of complete loss, when everything is gone, for my instinctive response to be a grief that bows down and worships God. I feel inspired when I read about Job. I look at some of the ordinary moments of my life, just like the ordinary frustrations of life. Like last week, I got sick, just like Pastor David, but a week earlier, but right in the middle of our summit weekend activities, and I was feeling really inconvenienced. It was not an ideal time for me to get sick. And then just 2 days ago, on Friday, we were hosting the district event. Pastor David was talking about for people all over Northern California who are preparing to be ministers, and I get called out of a cohort group that I'm facilitating because the urinal in the men's bathroom has broken. And my first reaction wasn't to pray or worship God. I was super annoyed. Which makes me like legitimately wonder, would I draw near to God? Laying my life before God in worship, if I lost everyone and everything that mattered to me most. Job inspires me. But when I look at Job and then I look at myself, this inspiration quickly turns into something else, a different sort of feeling. As I've been preparing to teach and preach from this book, I have been overwhelmed by the sense that I am profoundly unqualified to preach about Job's suffering. You've heard me say this before, but my personal experience with suffering and loss is incredibly thin. But what you haven't heard me share, at least not like this explicitly, is that I have an intense aversion to pain. In high school, some of you heard this story, I wasn't a good football player because I didn't like to be hit or to hit. Apparently, that's an important part of that sport. Up until recently, I've been a runner most of my life, but most of my running has involved like not running fast enough or hard enough or long enough so that it like hurts, which is why it's only been in my 30s. As I've started to discover the growth that's available through some pain and struggle, that I've been able to push myself past some running limits that I thought were beyond me. But it's also more than just physical pain that I seem to have an allergy to. I spent most of my life trying not to feel any of the painful or uncomfortable emotions. As a teenager, I became an expert at avoiding painful feelings. And as I got older, my strategies only became more sophisticated and socially acceptable to avoid these sorts of feelings. It was only in the last couple years, and you've heard me process some of this before, that I discovered that it is pain and uncomfortable feelings that make binge watching TV such a powerful temptation for me. You know, I've discovered that watching one show after another has this numbing quality to it. It's such an easy escape from feeling hard stuff. And it comes with this is the benefit, it comes with none of the social stigma of drugs and alcohol or whatever else a person might turn to avoid these sorts of things. Last summer during my sabbatical, I read the book Unbroken, which I know some of you have read, the story of Louis Zamperini. It was turned into a movie a few years ago, but it's about the Olympic runner who went off to war and barely survived as a prisoner of war. It's a powerful story, what he endured. More than a decade ago, I read the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who tells the story of his own survival in a Nazi concentration camp and what he endured, the incredible suffering. I read books like these, and I am completely overwhelmed by the pain that a human being can endure and live through, and that people have chosen to endure incredible suffering. And I'm also struck as I read these sorts of books by those who in the same situations give up. Just give in. The pain is just too much. It's not worth it. So it's interesting. I don't have a lot of personal experience with incredible pain. And like I said, I like to joke around that I have like an intense allergy to it. And so there are these days where I wonder, like, what in the world God was doing calling me to be a pastor? Because a significant part of what I get to do is walk with people through pain. And often this has meant helping some carry incredible amounts of pain. And I know I've been with many of you through incredibly painful moments. It's interesting when I think about it that before I was a pastor, there were very few, if any, men that I had ever seen cry. Before I was a pastor, I had never heard what you might call like wailing. But this work that God has called me to has brought me into contact with such deep grief and loss and pain that I've now heard cries, like the deep, intense sort of wailing that you wouldn't even recognize as human. The kind that can't be consoled, but where all you can do is like hold someone as they cover your clothes in tears and snot and spit and sweat. If anything, these experiences help me read this passage and identify with Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, the friends who see Job's great suffering and who have no words, and so they simply sit with their friend. But if you know where Job's going, you know that there's a danger of identifying with Job's friends too closely. We'll hear more about them next week. But the moment Job begins to speak, the moment he's ready to begin verbally expressing, processing his grief, these friends are also ready to speak. They were willing to be silent as long as they got a chance to speak, to explain his grief to them, to explain his grief to him. And they come with answers, and they come with solutions, and they come with explanations, and none of them are helpful. In fact, Job will later describe their help as an additional sort of torture. Rather than helping, they further hurt Job. So, like I said, we're gonna explore the friends a bit more in depth next week. But for now, I just want to consider, who is Job? How is he able to endure this incredible suffering? And so maybe you find some ways in which you understand or identify with it, his suffering, and maybe you struggle too. And so I hope that I might be able to offer something here that brings us into what God might be offering us. So if you look with me at chapter 2, it's interesting. Chapter 2 begins the exact same way as chapter 1, verse 6. They're identical. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And the adversary also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to the adversary, "From where have you come?" The adversary answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." This is word for word what we read last week. So hopefully you remember what's kind of happening here. But if you weren't here with us last week, this is the quick summary of what we're seeing. God is the boss of heaven and earth. God has called his regular staff meeting, which means all of the sons of God or these spiritual beings who live and work in heaven that God has given responsibility to, they have come together for the staff meeting in order to report back to God, their boss. And the adversary, who last week we thought of as the quality assurance manager, is also back. Now, he left the last meeting with a job to do. And now he's supposedly gone out, done his job, and he's come back to report to God. In essence, this is what we hear from the adversary. The adversary claims to have been doing his job. He repeats the same report he gave last time. He's traveling the world that God made, and he's testing it, making sure it holds up under scrutiny, and he's very general and vague in his report. It's funny, though. The adversary says nothing about Job. During the last meeting that the adversary and the sons of God had with God, the adversary made this huge deal about Job and about whether or not Job feared God because of all the ways that God had blessed him. The adversary had claimed to find a flaw in God's world. This is a big claim. But the adversary goes out, puts Job to the test, and as we learned at the end of chapter 1, in all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. So the adversary was wrong about Job. And he did what I do when Jane pronounces a word wrong. And I tell her that she pronounced the word wrong. And she denies that she's wrong. So I Google it. And then I put my phone away. To which Jane asks, "Did you just put your phone away? Were you looking it up? I was right, wasn't I?" No. It's the same thing. This is what God does when the adversary conveniently leaves out the details about Job. Verse 3, the Lord said to the adversary, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Do you hear what the Lord is asking? After everything Job has suffered, God is repeating God's self word for word. But God isn't done. God now elaborates a bit. Speaking of Job, God says he still holds fast his integrity. "Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Fascinating. First of all, great move by God, not letting anyone forget the job the adversary left with after the last meeting. God lays it out. "You went out to test Job. Have you considered what I claimed about him? Does it hold up?" And without waiting for an answer, God declares, "Not only is Job everything I said he was, but even under pressure, even while being tested by you, he held together. Job maintained his integrity." Like, that's not a bad compliment to get from God. But then God specifically addresses the adversary. Last week he asked this question, "Does Job fear God for no reason?" One chapter later, God responds, "You wanted to destroy Job for no reason." This phrase, no reason, is a deliberate echo. And it serves to bring us into one of the main themes of this entire book. And you could summarize this theme with the single word, why. Why? The book of Job revolves around this question. And not necessarily just why is Job suffering, but why anything? The adversary wanted to know why Job fears God. And in looking for an answer to his why, the adversary finds himself questioning God's own words, God's own assessment of Job. God sees Job clearly, but the adversary doesn't believe God's assessment holds up. He questions the truth in God's claim. The adversary sees no reason why Job would remain faithful to God. He questions whether God is enough. And this is the amazing thing about God in this passage. And I mentioned this last week, but it's worth saying again and seeing how this works itself out in this book. God is not threatened by the adversary's question. God allows the world that God made. God allows God's own character and even the sufficiency of God to be questioned and challenged and put to the test. It's fascinating. Here, God makes it clear there is insufficient reason for the adversary to doubt God. No reason, God says. God could see in Job what the adversary couldn't. And this will end up being, I think, one of the major points of this book. God can always see more than God's creatures. And so we make one of three mistakes. In our lack of understanding, not having God's understanding, we imitate the adversary. And we claim that there is no reason. With a lack of vision or a lack of God's vision, we imitate Job's wife and claim that God is the reason. Or in our overly simplistic view of the world, we imitate Job's friends who will say Job is the reason. As we get at some point to the end of the book, we might hope to find a reason and to answer our why questions, especially if this is a book about why. But Job won't give us that. Instead, the book of Job will give us God. The God who made all of this. The God who continues today to hold it all together. The God who created the boundaries between the waters and the dry land. The God who keeps the Leviathan and the behemoth under control. This God is good. This God can be trusted with our whys. This is what the book of Job will declare. But interestingly, it doesn't mean that we don't ask them anyway. Job certainly has some really strong words for God in the chapters to come. But at a minimum, it means that we should be humble with any answers that we think we might have. Anytime we think we might have an answer to one of these whys, we need to be humble about what we might know in light of God. I actually think a part of what God is referring to when God speaks of Job's integrity is that in his why, Job, at a minimum, refuses to place blame anywhere. You can hear it in his final question, shall we receive good from God and shall we not receive bad? I don't think, in light of the whole book and everything that's in it, that Job is saying that good and bad all come from God. The main point of this question, the main subject in this actual line is whether we will receive good and bad. Suffering is what it is. Will we fight it? Will we blame others for it? Will we run from it? Or is there a way to receive suffering as an opportunity? Throughout the book, Job seizes the opportunity of his suffering to seek God, to pray, to draw near to God, to worship his God. Everyone else around Job is looking to blame, is assigning blame. Edwin Friedman was a rabbi and a family therapist. Decades ago, he wrote a book in which he diagnosed America as a chronically anxious society. And now he wasn't speaking about individuals having clinical anxiety, but he was describing collectively that we are suffering from a shared anxiety about the world as it changes rapidly around us. And one of the symptoms of this anxiety is our constant need to find someone or something to blame for everything, for anything going wrong in our lives or not the way that we want it to. And this takes place in our neighborhoods and in our schools and in churches and in our government. This was decades ago that he offered this diagnosis. But you only have to listen for a second to hear one political party blaming immigrants for everything wrong with America and the other blaming bigots. If you listen for just a moment, blaming is happening all around us all the time. So often and so much of it that we have begun to tune it out. We don't even hear it anymore. I enjoyed this podcast series earlier this year by Michael Lewis, who was the author of Moneyball and The Big Short. Maybe you've read them or seen the movies. But this podcast series is on our growing disdain. The whole series is about how much as a society we're growing to hate referees. Sorry, Bridget. She's a soccer ref. He focuses on basketball. Where the refs today are actually quantifiably significantly better than they have ever been. Basketball referees, professional, are fantastic. And yet, the hostility towards refs is worse than ever. Not just by fans, but actually by star players. And so he explores this question, why refs? Why do we hate refs so much? And a huge part is that they are right at the center of so much of our lives. Not just sports refs, but people who technically referee our economy and government and all these other places. And they are easy to blame. They're easy to blame. Friedman would say that we have been raised and nurtured in a society of blame. And so I wonder if Job might offer us an alternative path forward. Like, the guy has lost everything, and yet there is a peace that marks his life in the midst of real grief. It doesn't diminish his grief, his loss, his pain, but there is a real peace evident in him, an abiding trust in the goodness of his God. There is a sense that he can either fight his circumstances or he can receive them. And in receiving them, he can seek and he can worship God. I mentioned last week that in some really profound ways, Job helps prepare us to hear the story of Jesus. Looking down over the earth God created, God could blame the humans for their sin, blame the enemy for deceiving us, blame sin for being so tempting. God could blame. But the story of Jesus is the story of a God who so loved the world that God gave God's only begotten Son. And the next verse story is also that God did not send God's son to condemn or blame the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And so God chooses not to blame the world or those who inhabit it, but instead God takes on flesh and he bears the sin of the world. God takes responsibility for sin, to deal with it, to forgive it, to free the world from it. And it costs God deeply. God suffers for our sake. In the large story of Job, Job will suffer. And in his suffering, in his righteous suffering, he will be invited to intercede for his friends who have sinned against God. God will invite him, Job, to take on himself the blame that his friends deserve. I think this is incredible news. News that we need to remember and be reminded of. That God is not in the blaming business. He's in the restoring business. And as we look on Jesus on the cross, especially in this season of Lent, may we be compelled to resist blaming ourselves, one another, or even God. And may we catch a glimpse of the God who takes the blame freely and willingly upon himself so that we might walk freely into relationship with him. So that we might boldly approach the altar, as we sang earlier. So that we might approach the table, the place of fellowship, the place where we are brothers and sisters in God's family.